Welcome to the podcast. I am sitting here with Julie Taylor, and I have actually been following Julie for quite a few years on Instagram, I think before she became so famous on.
Still waiting for the fame, to be fair.
Famouser. Anyways, so she is really fun to follow, really down to earth, and I just like her perspective on life. So Julie, with that, can you just introduce yourself and let us know why we want to know you?
No, that's very kind of you. Thank you. I always have a hard time introducing myself because I change what I do so dramatically so often. So I don't like to be held to anything. Don't label me. Don't put me in a box. But I do a lot of things. I love to write. I talk a lot about personal development, motherhood, things like that on the internet. And then I do some business coaching things on the side. So just kind of whatever I feel like that day. That's what I do.
Awesome. That is good. And you will see as we go along in this little presentation of your family that you are not alone in that. that you have some other ancestors that maybe didn't stick with one thing for their whole life. So
that's where I get it. That's good to know.
It is good to know. All right. Well, let's just get started. I decided to start as far back as we could with your Taylor line. So with your father's line, Taylors. And I'm going to show you some pictures as we go along. So if you are just listening, you won't be able to see these. But if you go to YouTube, you'll be able to see some of these pictures that I share with Julie. Okay, so your Taylor line comes from England, Wiltshire, England, and specifically Trowbridge. That's where your third great-grandfather, William Joseph Taylor, was born in 1832. And this picture here that I'm showing you is the church that he was baptized in. Their family was nonconformist, which means that they did not belong to the Church of England. He was baptized Presbyterian. I'm not sure how active they were in that faith or whatever, but that's what he was baptized as when he was 3 years old. And he was the third of five children born to William Taylor and Winifred Hewitt. Wow. So this is the church is now demolished. It was turned into a public library, and then it was demolished in 1959, I think. So it's not there anymore, but kind of cool. Wow. Yeah, so they lived in Trowbridge. This is probably the early 1900s in Trowbridge, but it is the same street that church was on, which would have been nearby where they lived. So his father was a cloth worker. There was about like 20 woolen cloth factories in Trowbridge. It was a city of about 10,000. And so it's probably what a lot of the people did in the area. So your third great grandfather also worked at this woolen cloth factory before he came to the United States.
So is all of this gone now? I mean, you might not know that. But
No, there's still, I mean, in England, the buildings are so old. Like, I'm sure if you went to Trowbridge to the street that he was baptized on, then there's another street called The Have, like H-A-L-V-E, that I looked up, and it's still there. There's still all old houses there. So there's probably, I don't know the exact house that he lived in, but it would have been one of them there. So, So when he was about 18, he was baptized into the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. He was the only one in his family that was baptized.
Really?
He married. Yeah, he was. At least none of them look like they had. I don't actually know for sure, but he was the only one that came to Utah. And yeah, so he married Mary Bowring in 1853. Now her father was a carriage worker, like a carriage builder. So he would build carriages, and I guess she would travel around with him to like Ireland and different places where he would sell them and give them to people. And she was also baptized, and they were married. And then 6 days later, they set sail to go to Utah. And I just think that's kind of crazy. Wow. 6 days later. So they were married January 30th, and they set sail February 5th in 1853.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was after they were both baptized.
That was after they were both baptized. They traveled with 314 other saints, other members of the church to New Orleans is where they landed. And then they went by like a ship up the Mississippi to St. Louis. And then they went in hand carts over to Salt Lake City.
Wow.
So it took 8 months total from England to Salt Lake City. And they arrived in Salt Lake City in September 27th of that same year, 1853.
Wow.
So what do you think about that? Like, what do you think would have been going through their minds or their families' minds as they made this trek?
That's interesting, because you said they came to Utah. So they literally left specifically to come to Utah.
Yes.
Like, not come to America. They, like, left to come to Utah.
Yes. Yeah.
I guess I just never, I mean, it seems insane, right? Like, out of
context. It does.
It seems insane to, like, join a church and then set sail and then, like, go to this whole unknown place. And I guess I wonder, like, what their conversion to the faith was like, because it must have been pretty intense to, like, create that kind of pilgrimage, like the desire for that, especially to leave their families. Like, if they
leave their families, right? Yeah. And I didn't actually find much about, like, their conversion, like why they chose. I believe William, he like heard some missionaries teaching someone else and then was interested and soon after decided to be baptized. But I'm
I feel like it would make more sense if like the whole family did it, but like it's very like revolutionary to just do that and do it on their own, especially after they were married.
Right. Yeah. No, it is. It is, I mean, it's a huge thing. I'm sure they had no understanding of even what Utah was. And maybe if they did, they wouldn't have come.
What the church was at that point. Right. Like, who really understood any of it? So,
yeah.
Wow.
And now William, he did serve a mission before he was married. So he was baptized and then served a mission in Ireland for a time before he was married. So, I'm sure that was an interesting thing, because I've heard that that there was persecution among the missionaries and things in those areas too. So I'm sure, he was not a wussy guy. He would have had to be pretty strong, like, to do that.
Strong to make that decision and do such a drastic change. That's, it does seem like something I would do, moving across the world 6 days after.
Why not?
Not really.
Yeah. So once they arrived in Utah and Salt Lake City, pretty soon Brigham Young asked them to move near Provo because they were going to be building a woolen cloth factory. And I'm sure because of his experience, his family's experience in that, he was asked to go down there and to kind of oversee the carding department, which I think is when they kind of spin it actually into string or fabric. I don't really know, but that they put it on cards. I don't know. So that was his kind of opportunity to start a career of some sort. So he did that, and he served in lots of different callings as bishop, as different things. And he was actually a peace officer in Provo for a time. Anyways, so he had married Mary Bowring, right? So they came over, went down to Provo. His wife, Mary, actually started a school in their home at this time. They had seven children of their own, and she started a school for other children in the area. So she must have been well-educated, I'm guessing, to be able to feel like she could do that. This was also the time of polygamy. So William did marry a second wife, Rebecca Harris, in 1860. And they had two children. Then I'm just going to share with you this article you can read. Okay. Now it might be kind of blurry. But I don't know. Can you read that?
Yes. You want me to read it out loud?
Yes.
In Provo City on Tuesday, the 18th, William J. Taylor, after a short illness, aged 37 years, Brother Taylor was born July 7th, 1832 at Trowbridge, Wiltshire, England. He was baptized March 17th, 1849 at the same place and emigrated to this city in 1852. He was a member of the 34th Quorum of the 70s. By his consistent course, he won the respect and confidence of all who knew him. He has left a large family and numerous circle of friends to regret his early departure.
Yeah, so he was only 37. He was only 37 at this time when he died.
All of that before he was 37?
Yes.
Like, that's a lot to do.
It is a lot.
Wow.
Yeah, and it said that he died from brain fever, which is possibly like meningitis or something, swelling of the brain, which I'm sure was not an enjoyable way to die. Yeah. But yeah, he was only 37. He left behind 9 children and 2 wives. His oldest child was only 15. His youngest was, I believe, like a year and a half.
Wow.
Yeah. So your second great grandfather was about 10 years old at this time, and he was the oldest son. So a lot of that...
Of the first wife or the second wife?
Of the first wife. Yeah. So, yeah. Of the first wife, he was about 10 years old. And he was now the man in the house, right? And at that time, like, they were scrappy. Like, they had to make things work. And he started working. He worked at the woolen cloth factory and made things work. But what do you think that might have been like for them at that time?
Did do you know if the school continued? Like, was did
Mary... I'm not sure. Well, I'm not sure.
I just am, like, I'm wondering what, like, if she was able to keep doing that, or if you know, what other kind of work had to be done to keep things going. And, like, right. I've known that as we'll get more recent in my line. Like, I know that's how I knew my grandparents, was that kind of, like, crazy dairy farmer work ethic. Mm-hmm. And it makes a lot of sense to just see that that was, you know, passed down all along. And I just think about, like, how cush my own life is now. Now,
seriously.
Like, the comparison of just, like, I mean, I'm 35, so that's why when I said he did all of that by the time he's 37, because it just, I don't feel like I've quite done that level of stuff, which I'm not, it's not better or worse. I just, it's interesting to think about how different it is, but also the same of, like, the constant work and things passed down.
Yeah, for real. Like, yeah. So I guess they did have some land. William had, like, they had some land that they kind of farmed a bit. It didn't sound like they had a ton of land, but they did work the land left by their father, is what it said. So I'm not sure exactly.
Land that, like, they have today?
No, it was different land. Yeah. Yeah, it was different. And so they kind of made it work and survived all of the children kind of helping out and making it work. So then, like I said, he did weave for a time. I think he said he started when he was 15. He worked at that factory. And then in 1882, that's when he married Abby Jane Scott. So now I want to talk a bit about her family.
We'll be right back after hearing about one of our sponsors. Are you curious about your family history but don't know where to start? Find My Past can help. With billions of records from around the world, Find My Past is the perfect place to start uncovering your family story. Whether you are just starting out or have been researching for years, their easy-to-use platform makes discovering your ancestors a breeze. Their extensive collection includes everything from birth, marriage, and death records to military and census records. And with their powerful search tools, you can quickly filter and narrow your results to find exactly what you're looking for. Plus, with exclusive access to the largest collection of British and Irish parish records online, you're sure to find something that you won't find anywhere else. Also, their exclusive newspapers collection lets you explore the stories and events that shaped your ancestors' lives. Join the millions of people who have already discovered their family's history with Find My Past. With a 14-day free trial and affordable subscription options, there's never been a better time to start your journey of discovery. Visit Find My Past today and start exploring your family's past. And now we're back.
So So Abby Jane Scott, her father, Andrew Scott, was born in Pennsylvania, married a woman named Sarah Sleeper, and they had five children. When Andrew joined the church, she was not very happy about it and was not very supportive. And so I'm going to show you a little bit about her. Okay. Can you read that?
During the spring of 1850, he began making preparations to go to Utah. His wife was very much opposed to the movement. She was a very devout Methodist. Finding her husband was determined to go west, she took advantage of an absence of her husband from home and sold everything, leaving the two little boys, Hiram and George, and half of the money with a neighbor, and taking the three little girls with her. She left home. When he returned, he found them gone, which one can imagine was a sad blow to him. Although he hunted everywhere for them, he could neither find them or information as to where they could be. It was thought her parents had sent her away someplace to keep her from going west. Andrew did not let this turn him from his determination to go with the saints.
Yeah.
Oh, my word. That's insane. I know.
So I was a little confused when I was starting to research. I'm like, oh, well, because you're that Abby Jane, she came from a different wife. And I'm like, well, where did this other wife come from? Where did she go? Turned out she never came. So.
Okay. So he came alone with the boys?
He came alone with the boys. Yeah, he brought the boys. And actually on his journey to Salt Lake, he met Sarah Rowe. So she was, I think she was only 18 when they got married, but she kind of helped care for the two little boys in their company or whatever. And he ended up marrying her in 1851, I think was the year. So they got married and then got to Utah. They had 11 children. And one of those children was Abby Jane Scott, who eventually married William Joseph Taylor. The reason I want to talk about them is the Scott family, they lived close. So they actually, the dairy farm was with them too. So I wanted to kind of piece together how they were related and all of that. So this,
we will get to this. My family moved to Utah when I was in junior high. And the first Sunday that we went to church, my dad made a joke and he was like, well, you can't like anyone, like any boys that are in this ward because you're related to all of them. Because there's like the Bunnell farm and the Scott farm and the Johnson farm. And like all of them go far back enough that we're all like cousins in some way.
Oh, so funny.
it's a funny little.
Yes. School. Yeah. Yeah. So Abby was from that Scott family, from the second wife of Andrew. And she grew up, I guess her father also planted fruit trees, Andrew, and it was said, I'm like, there's so many things I read now, I don't know if I have that here, but it was said that he was like the first person to plant fruit trees in Utah County.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. So she kind of grew up with a farm and orchard and that sort of thing, and then married William Joseph Taylor Jr. in 1882. So this William Joseph Jr., he's the one, he had a lot of occupations when I look through his history. So he first was the weaver. He did some at the woolen factory. Then he went up to help build the railroad to Salt Lake City. He was also a farmer for a time. Then he went to the Spanish Fort Canyon and worked at the charcoal kilns. Not exactly sure what he did there. He was also, after they were married, he was called as a missionary to the southern states, and he was gone for a time. And then when he came back, he helped build a street railway. He was an assistant mechanic at the woolen mills. He was the Provo City water master for a time. He was also a fire chief and the city sexton.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
So all of these things. And I'm like, I don't think he was even that old by the time. So eventually in 1906, with having seven sons, well, a bit before 19, so like 1900s about, he's like, I feel like I need to get a farm for these seven sons that we have something that they can do to work and help build their own income and sort of thing. So they decided to find a farm. So they moved to a farm in Vineyard, but I guess the mud was so deep and the roads were not paved and it was just kind of a mess when it was in wet seasons. So they only lived there for 1 year. And then they found the farm. They found the farm that you are so familiar with. Okay, so here, this was just in one of these little histories that are on his memories and family search. So it just says at the top that they purchased the J.J. Dilatouche, I don't know, or George C. Scott farm in Lakeview. So George C. Scott, he bought this plot of land, which I'll just show you here. It is right here. So this is like the 28th section. And he got this bottom southeast corner of it, which you can see is right along the Geneva Road, I think is goes like right through it. Does that sound right? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sitting a mile away from there right now.
Oh, cool. And I went to BYU and I remember driving on this road and I'm sure I drove past that. So that's very cool. So that was the land that they, George C. Scott, originally got in 1880. He was Abby Jane's half-brother. So he was one of those boys that his mom abandoned and left. He is one of those boys of Andrew Scott, and he's the one that originally got this land. So then your great-great-grandfather, William Joseph Taylor, purchased that land in about 1906, and that's where they started their dairy farm and things. It seems like some of the Scotts, so this George C. Scott that got it in 1880, it seems like his son also helped mm-hmm. with the farm too. Right. Yeah. So they were related, which I wasn't sure how after I heard the Scott name, I'm like, they must have been, but that is how they are half brother wow. to Abby.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is the William Joseph Taylor family. They had 11 children and they all lived to adulthood, which I thought wow. was amazing, especially yeah. at that time. And this is your, sure. this is your great grandfather, I believe. Yes. William Weldon Taylor. Is that right? Yep. Yeah.
That's so cool.
Yeah, so I guess he was kind of the push to build to purchase that farm. He was about 20 when they got it and got married shortly after. And I guess he was really pushing for that to happen. So after moving to the Cherry Hill Farm, he was actively engaged in that activity. So this is William Weldon, so your great grandfather. His first business entry was in about 1908 when he operated the Lakeview Dairy jointly with George Scott. So it was Will's idea. It was his idea. And a few years later, they organized the dairy known as Cherry Hill, which he operated in conjunction with his father and brothers. But later it was dissolved as a family unit and Will continued to own and operate this business until his death in 1938. Which made a total of 30 years that he spent dairying.
Wow.
And it said that the operation of the dairy was carried on at the Lakeview Farm until 1925 when he purchased the site and constructed the new building just off Center Street, 4th West and Provo, where his dairy products were prepared for and dispersed for distribution. So it sounds like he had a little store on Center Street.
Cool.
To sell that stuff. So, and then I thought it was interesting. I found them in this is the 1920 census. So you can see here's the father, William Joseph Taylor. He's age mm-hmm. 60, says dairy farmer. And then we have the George C. Scott Jr. He's also living there with his family. And then we have Glenn L. Taylor, which is, a son of William Joseph, and then W.W. Taylor, William Weldon, your great-grandfather with his family, and then Joseph, which is another brother. So they were all living there, all working on the dairy farm and the farm there, which is kind of cool. So I'm curious what So this is kind of to the point of your great grandfather, right? And then your grandfather also worked on the land there. I think he said that he was in real estate at some point and started renting out some of the land. So I'm curious, you probably know more now.
Well, I know they sold the dairy herd when my dad was like 10. My dad's the youngest. Okay. So I think he was like 9 or 10 when they sold it. And then after that, my understanding is that my grandpa just did other things like real estate ventures and things. And then when I was 10 or 11, we moved from St. Louis to Provo, and my parents built a house on that same farm, the Cherry Hill Farm, to kind of help let it go down another generation. But it was not like there was no animals. It was no, like, my wedding reception was in the barn. Like, it's just become more of like a venue. But then they do lease out like all of the fields to like local farmers so that they do like the alfalfa fields. And then recently we've got cows back on the property, and we've started doing some more farmy type things with it. So that's been kind of in the last 5-ish years that we've done that. So I was really close with my grandpa because when we moved here from St. Louis, I just spent a ton of time with him and up until his death. And so I got to know him really well. We were very close, and he had this vision of Cherry Hill and like what he wanted it to be and how he wanted it to be used. And I just was kind of like instilled with that vision. And so then that's been something that's really important to me. So it's just really cool to see how far this goes back and just kind of the line of like, I think I understand more now, like why it matters so much to me, because it really does go back so far. And to think of kind of the founding of Provo, like my family's been here since then. Like that's crazy. I always, I didn't know. Like I left Utah for a long time, and coming back here, we actually built a house a mile away from that farm. So we don't live on the farm, but we live close and we spend a lot of time there. And it's always felt like sacred ground to me. And I feel like now knowing like just how deep the roots are there and in Provo in general, it makes a little more sense to me of why I feel so pulled to this land and this area. So it's just really cool.
That is very cool. And I think, I don't know, just seeing the pride that they had in that farm, like I think even just to name your farm something, like I don't think many people name their farm, but they like made it into an exciting, like a fun business. And there was lots of things I read about, you know, that all of those brothers would be going around town delivering the milk and in their milk wagon and things. And your family was a huge part of Provo and the building of the people there and the serving of the people there. So
that school, like I just the founding and how they were kind of, and it makes me feel like that entrepreneurial spirit goes back a long ways, and the feeling of like wanting to do stuff and naming it something. It's funny that you say that, because like I've been a copywriter by trade. Like I name everything. Everything has a slogan. Everything has a tagline. And like we branded the logo. Just last week we had our Easter brunch at the farm, and I got everyone water bottle stickers with that dairy logo, because we all love our logo. And it's carried on. So it's cool to see how far it goes back, because I only know firsthand my grandpa, you know, and before that I've never really dug into any of this stuff. So
yeah. So it started with your second great grandfather, William Joseph Taylor. So it's pretty cool. Well, it was a lot of fun to research your family, and that's really only one little branch.
One side. Yeah. Yeah.
One little part.
There's scandal. It's crazy.
Yes. Abandoning children, you know. Yeah.
No, that's really, really cool.
Yeah. Well, how does that feel kind of knowing a little more about your family?
You know, it's interesting, and I don't know, we don't have to get like deep into this, but like I've known that I have deep like LDS roots, but I don't think I ever, I mean, obviously my last name's Taylor and I've kept my last name. So that shows you how much I care about my family, like name and heritage, because I am married and I kept my name. But it's really powerful for me, like to see how far back that faith goes and like how much they sacrifice taste for it. And it makes me frame it a little bit differently because they obviously believed in it in a way that maybe I never have had to. Mm-hmm. And like sacrificed more for it. And like their level of conviction was deeper than I understood, I think. Mm-hmm. And to like emigrate for it and then just like serve and work and build up a whole, it makes me wonder like how different it would be if they didn't convert and what, you know, right. What else would have happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, they left a huge legacy, and you can just see it as I was looking through their profiles and their memories and things on there. It's like, I know I could just tell that they were, I don't know why I'm getting emotional, it's your family, but like they were strong people. They were people that created, that helped build the area and just lifted each other up. And it's a powerful thing to see people do that. And so it was really a lot of fun to look at your family tree and to learn more about them. So after this is over, I'm going to show you how you can find some more about your family, because there's honestly like hundreds and hundreds of pages that people have written about your family. And wow. It's powerful stuff to know those stories of your ancestors. And I know that you know that. And
power of like how much it makes me feel, because we look to like our siblings or our cousins or our parents, and sometimes when we feel different than them, it's like, well, where did I come from? Like, why am I like this? And then to see those patterns of like go that far back, and I'm not trying to assign too much meaning to things, but it makes sense to me of why I feel this like crazy. My family, my husband and children, we moved back to Utah from Connecticut a few years ago mm-hmm. for the sole purpose of being closer to the farm and to be on this land and to be, and I've always just felt so called to carry on this legacy in a million ways. And this, I don't know, I'm getting emotional because it just gives me a lot of meaning of, sometimes I think I'm silly for how much I care about it and how much mm-hmm. it just seems so special to me. And it seems really important to preserve and to carry on the legacy. And then witnessing, reading these stories and seeing how hard these people worked to build this and to found this and how much they cared about it. Right. I don't feel silly at all.
Right.
For how much I care about it and why I feel so called to it. Cause I think that like our roots go deeper than we realize. And when I stand on that ground, I'm standing where all of them have stood, and I'm mm-hmm. feeling all of that hard work and all of that learning and all of that sacrifice. And that's in me too. And it kind of makes me double down on my determination to carry that on, because wow. it's important.
I love that. So. Well, thank you so much, Julie, for being here and for sharing.
Thanks and for doing all that work. That's so much work you just did.
It was fun. I like, honestly, I could do it for hours, but I only like just touched the tip of the iceberg. So there's so much more that you can learn about them. And I'm grateful for you for being here and letting me do that for you. How can people find you? I know on Instagram might be the best way to.
Oh yeah. Just on Instagram. I'm the Julie Taylor, the one and only. There's actually a lot of Julie Taylors, but yeah,
I'll link you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Julie.
So normally at this point, we have a tip from the genealogist. Well, in this case, I was the one that compiled the research for Julie. Her tree had already been very well researched. She has lots of information, lots of pictures, lots of documents about her ancestors. So we didn't need a genealogist to research for her. So I was able to take a look at her tree and find some interesting things to share with her based on what she was curious about and based on what I thought was interesting to share with her. So if you have a family tree like Julie, maybe it's been really well researched, maybe it goes back super far, and you don't know how you can start really learning about your ancestors or doing family history work. Well, you don't need to always research to do family history work. You can just learn about your ancestors. So like I did with Julie, just choose an ancestor to start learning about. See where they were born. See if you can find that place on Google Maps. See if you can find out what their occupation was based on census records that have already been found for them. Just look at the records, look at the memories that have been found for them, and start learning about them. And as you do, you will find similarities to yourself. You'll find things, patterns, and things that have gone through the generations to yourself. As you learn more about your ancestors, you can feel more connected to them, and it can really be a strength in your life. Do you want to be on the podcast? Do you want to be a guest where we have a genealogist research your family tree for about 5 hours to see what we can find out about them, about your ancestors, and then we can share it with you? Well, we are doing a fun giveaway on Instagram and Facebook. You will need to go to Know Your Ancestors on Facebook or Megan Hillier on Instagram to find the post that talks all about the giveaway. So what I'm giving away is a seat on the podcast. So maybe you have some mysteries in your family tree that having a professional genealogist could really help with. Maybe you know nothing about your family history and want to learn more. I am giving away a seat to the podcast if you leave a review on iTunes. Now, I know not everyone has an iPhone, me included, so if you can't leave a review on iTunes, you can go ahead and rate it on Spotify, but I'd really love for you to leave a review on iTunes. You actually can do it if you don't have an iPhone, you just need to do it on a desktop computer. So if you go and leave a review, go to the post on either Facebook or Instagram and comment and say that you've left a review or rating, and you will be entered to win a seat on the podcast. If you want to leave a rating and review, but you really don't want to be on the podcast, maybe you already know a lot about your family, or the idea of being on a podcast frightens you, I will give you $100 instead. So either way, you can win a seat on the podcast or $100, up to you, by leaving a review and rating on iTunes. So go to the post on Instagram or Facebook to learn more about that. I will link that in the show notes and enter to win that. The deadline to enter is May 15th, so get those reviews in. And the reviews on iTunes do take a few days to show up. So if you're going to do it as quick as you can so we can see those reviews and make sure that you did that. All right, thanks so much for your support. Sharing and leaving reviews for this podcast is really the way for it to grow, to get the word out, and to get more listeners. So thanks again for listening today, and we'll see you next week.